This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. I'm Jack Mendel, and coming up on this program, we look at the community as coronavirus restrictions are lifted. Today I'm joined by Raymond Simonson, Chief Executive of JW3, Rabbi Charlie Baginski, the Chief Executive Officer of Liberal Judaism, Daniel Carmel Brown, the CEO of Jewish Care, and Rabbi Alex Chapa of Boroughwood and Elstree United Synagogue. I'd like to start by speaking to Daniel Carmel Brown about the impact of lifting restrictions on residents and service users at Jewish Care, because they may well be the most vulnerable members of our community and they may well be the most concerned at the lifting of restrictions. So how are you going to handle these restrictions being lifted?
Well, thank you, Jack, and it's nice to see colleagues or hear colleagues on the call as well. I think that it's interesting. I've just come from a staff forum, actually, which is a group of staff that represent the various resources across Jewish Care, both in London and the rest of the South East. And we've just been discussing this very issue. And the truth is that at this particular moment in time, we are going to be sticking with many of the restrictions and limitations that we have in place at the moment, as you say, because we are caring for and supporting the most vulnerable people in our community. In particular, in care homes, that means that there will still be testing for visitors, limits on the numbers of people that can be in at the same time, etc. And in our community provision, we are testing people before they come and arrive in our centres. Mask wearing is going to continue in communal areas, in our offices. We still have a hybrid arrangement, etc. And at this particular moment, we don't feel it's the right time to lift all of those restrictions. But that is because we're caring for the most vulnerable. The government guidance that was issued around the Living with COVID plan had very little about detail for adult social care when it was announced on Monday. But what we have been told is that in March, we will see more detail coming out for the sector that we operate in, and that we are going to wait until we see that before we make any decisions about the slightly longer term. So that's where we are at the moment, and we'll see where we get to in March and April.
If I could bring in Rabbi Alex Chapa. You are a rabbi at Boroughwood and Elstree United Synagogue. It's a very large community, the biggest community. So would you say that you might be filling in some of the gaps that weren't announced by the government when it comes to supporting older people, perhaps? Would you be helping more vulnerable people?
Good afternoon, Jack. Yes. So I almost sort of echo a little bit what Daniel said. Obviously, we as a community, we have a broad range of ages, people who have different responses in terms to the pandemic and now post-pandemic and moving forward. Obviously, we've been very cautious, and obviously we followed government guidelines, United Synagogue guidelines all the way through in order to protect our members so they feel comfortable coming onto site. I think the lifting of restrictions gives us an opportunity now to actually make local decisions about how we move forward, to give people perhaps more confidence about being able to come back to in-person events and services. But at the same time, we still need to be sensitive to the people who don't necessarily feel totally comfortable in that environment. We have to obviously cater for that as well. So we won't be rushing to dispense with all of the restrictions. At the moment, we are at the level where mask wearing is recommended, but not compulsory. I would say we have perhaps about a 50-50 split across our sites in terms of who chooses to wear masks, who doesn't. And we're still taking reasonable precautions. I think, again, we're following the government in terms of asking people to take responsibility for their actions and for them to make their choices. But obviously, we're aware that programming, both in person and online, will probably be with us for the foreseeable future.
And if I could turn to Rabbi Charlie, I think it would be fair to say that within liberal Judaism, there are more communities outside of the main population centres. There are smaller communities, and numbers can sometimes be a problem. So if there are concerns about catching coronavirus, how can you reassure people that it's okay to go to shul?
I mean, there's the big question. I'm not sure, honestly, how many people... There are people who are worried about health, but I'm not sure that the catching COVID is exactly the nature of the worry about going in back into buildings anymore. I recently heard that the Archbishop of Canterbury had been using my phrase from me. He did credit me, but of muscle memory. We've kind of lost the muscle memory of the habit of going into buildings and into public spaces. And because of that, it can feel also very scary when you go in and you suddenly see a load of people not wearing masks, or the journey that people have to get to shul, even if that's walking and walking along a street that's got a lot of other people on it. Those kind of memories come alongside a lot of fear. So the idea of going into a building, even if everybody's masked, we've lost that habit. And so I think it's kind of complicated. It's also made more complicated by the fact that, in all honesty, many of my congregants have quite enjoyed attending shul from their couch in their pyjamas. And actually, probably maybe some other people's members have quite enjoyed attending our services from the comfort of their couch as well. And so there's a bigger question about the values that are happening here, about the values of attending in person and that reconnecting with each other in a different way. And so I think in some ways that's the place that I'm starting, rather than the place of necessarily just, you know, we're all going to be wearing masks and there's going to be plenty of hand sanitizer and the buildings are going to be open, because I'm not sure that just telling people that is what is going to get them coming back. And in all honesty, we have to, as a movement, but also I know that, you know, Ray at JW3 will have similar questions about, like, what's the added value of being there in person, and without devaluing those people who actually have really enjoyed our services in the widest possible way from being at home, and not wanting to close the door to them either and say, you know, actually your attendance was really valuable when you could participate in that way, but no longer, actually, now it's not so valuable. What is really valuable is you being there. So we're wrestling with that. And I know that doesn't quite answer your question, but it is really, for me, about saying to people, we are talking about that. We're not just talking about masks. And
I would just echo what Charlie just said in terms of previous behaviours people have forgotten. Yeah, it's a funny story, but, you know, so every single morning now, or when I see new people I haven't seen for a while, they come into shul, we don't seem to know whether we should shake hands, we should fist bump, we should elbow bump, what can we hug each other? We just seem to have forgotten that, what the social norms are. And it's going to take us time to readjust to that and become comfortable again in each other's presence. But that's something so important, because I think, you know, we can never underestimate the social aspects of community and seeing people face to face and having that human contact, whether it be physical or virtual. So something really, again, that we've lost.
Yeah. If I could ask Ray, during the pandemic, you massively ramped up your online presence, and now you're trying to integrate your online presence with your physical presence. And indeed, you wrote a piece in this week's Jewish News saying that being open isn't just about having an open building. So what has been the response so far from people that use JW3 and all of its services? Are people sticking to online, or are they wanting to come back and sit in your auditorium and go to classes? And
so, thank you for inviting me on, and it's a great opportunity for me to also say, to sort of doff my virtual cap to my two rabbinic colleagues, and to Daniel, who have done just phenomenal jobs over the last 2 years that people just can't believe. And you know, I've been inspired by people like the other three guests and what they've done. We've tried to make all our decisions guided by the values we have. And like everyone else, we're weighing up, you know, practical physical health, mental health, and also our belief that bringing people together has a power in and of itself. And that the virtual communities that we've all been involved with, whether that's through services, lectures, or whatever, have a place and a power. But for me, nothing can really replace the real deep connections that can be made by bringing people together in a physical space, in a space where you can hold people, in a space where people are known and loved and are able to explore Jewish identity and Jewish ideas. So look, on speaking Tachlis, on a practical level, we went from a place that people knew as a building, right? People almost entirely encountered JW3 by coming through the doors. Like that, overnight, we went into a place where the doors were physically closed, and yet we managed to engage literally thousands of people every single week online, like so many other people have done. And then over the last, I don't know how many months now, we've been, you know, there's been this open, closed, open bit where restrictions get lifted a bit and then they get closed a bit. People start coming back. You know, we had this incredible period over Hanukkah where we had probably more people engaging with our Hanukkah activities in different demographics, activities we did for Russian Jewish communities or Israeli communities or LGBTQ communities, for children, for older people, for Holocaust. Like, it was incredible. And then 5 minutes later, all we were talking about was Omicron and people being encouraged to go back home and to go back online again. So again, we switched loads of our classes. You know, we have, I don't know, nearly 300 adults of all different ages every week taking regular Hebrew classes at JW3. And that all had to switch back online again because people were nervous. So we're just coming out. I like to think of it kind of as coming out of hibernation. And this habit forming and muscle memory that our two rabbis just spoke about, I think it's like this image I have is of these, you know, the baby cubs, the bears that come out of hibernation, and you watch them on a nature program. They're kind of slipping around a bit. They've got to find their way. They've got to work out how to forage for food. There is something about that. But I've seen in the last week, and you know, I'm at home today, but over the last week or so, I've been in every day at JW3 like I am most days, and seeing people come back in for their first time, the reaction is really moving. People have been tearful. People have been thanking us. People have been saying, oh, how much they missed us. People, you know, just sitting in the cafe, it's unbelievable what a difference it makes. Just the coming in and sitting in a cafe after a class or after a film or after a discussion to exchange thoughts and ideas and even disagreements for the sake of heaven with people that you didn't know before and you've just met over a coffee is a powerful thing that didn't quite happen in the same way over Zoom. But it is a mixture. There are people saying they're not ready to come back yet. So we're keeping everything that we can offer an option to also access online. We're now giving them that option, which is twice as much work for us. Our footprint is now far larger than our shoe size because we're reaching people far outside of Northwest London, far outside of London, and in some cases outside of the UK, who are now able to engage in the high quality conversations and events, and we'll keep that going. And there are some people who, just because of their mental health or their physical vulnerability, are not yet ready to come back in. So we're learning this new stage of really kind of multi-location accessing of our programmes.
That's a really interesting perspective. I was wondering if I could turn to Daniel Carmel Brown again. Have you spoken to any Holocaust survivors, perhaps, or people that use your services? Are they apprehensive about this change, or are they looking forward to seeing people they know and their family and their friends again?
Well, so interestingly, I was going to butt in and say that you know, for older people, I think there's been a very interesting dynamic because, as a proportion of their lifetime, it's obviously very different. And in my experience, we were under pressure to reopen our community day centres for people living with dementia, Holocaust Survivor Centre, as quickly as possible. And we did so last August. And they have remained open since, even through Omicron, because we insisted on testing people upon arrival. And in my conversations with those cohorts of members, and in particular Holocaust survivors, they just want to be together again, and they are more willing than most of us to face the future without the fear of worrying about COVID. Now, of course, we have to bear in mind that they're not just coming together on their own; they're with volunteers and staff and other members of the community, and so we have to be a bit cautious. But as a cohort, the vast majority of people who wanted to come back to our community day centre provisions, want to be back with others, and they are back now. So it's been the way since August. They care much less about the restrictions than I think the rest of society, because they have been through other experiences. And you know, we don't need to debate that now. But you know, as a comparator to what we've all lived through, obviously they will say, you know, we just need to get on with our lives.
Daniel, sorry, Daniel, I you just reminded me that we had some such funny encounters with some Shoah survivors, some Holocaust survivors who came in to some of the first events we brought back in with survivors. And everyone else was walking in wearing masks and none of the survivors were. And they were like, some of them berated me for not being open earlier. And they said, no, we're not going to wear masks. Like the line I kept getting told was, I survived Auschwitz. I can survive a bit of a virus. Or I live this long. I haven't got long left. Let me enjoy it. And we'd set them all up with these tables spread, right? And these seats spread. And every single one of them pulled their chairs along and sat together in one group. And most of them hadn't seen each other for ages, and they hugged and they kissed. And there's me, the one schmerl with the mask on, because I'm petrified that I might carry a germ off of the bus and give it to them. And they're just telling me, just take the mask off. What are you talking about? It was just, that spirit was unbelievable.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we've experienced throughout the services.
I'm going to throw this question out to anyone who wants to step in. Are any of you worried about having a difficult conversation with a congregant or somebody that wants to go to an event who is worried about having the virus, you might have to turn them away or something?
I mean, the whole way through this process from the beginning, there have been really difficult conversations. I mean, without question, we've had difficult conversations. We've had conversations, I think, that none of us, if you know, a couple of years ago, ever imagined having with people. And we've used a lot within our organisation, imagine within other organisations, the balance of risk versus impact. And it's really useful. It's really useful to think about that in terms of, and I think the risk impact level has shifted, actually. So early on in, had there been an outbreak within one of our organisations and we'd felt responsible for that, the impact would have been huge. And now the impact is reducing. And so I think as long as the way that we handle difficult conversations is in those terms. And I think also one of the things that's been great, really great, during this process has been the leveling of our institutions, in the sense that we have collaborated and cooperated in areas that I think, listen, there have definitely been arguments in other areas, but in this area, there have been collaboration, communication and transparency across the board. Talking with my, with other CEOs, with other religious leaders within the community has been amazing. And that level of cooperation has helped those difficult conversations as well. So it's heads up, transparency and risk and impact.
And do you think that will continue?
Absolutely. Yes. I think, you know, for a while longer, we're not out of this, right? We may be learning to live differently, but we all know we're not at the end of this, because there's a whole set of impacts we don't even know, you know, financial, mental health, social, all of those that we're going to have to carry on thinking about in these terms for a lot longer yet.
I'd be quite interested to hear how you're all adapting to these new challenges then. So as we move away from the direct impact of coronavirus itself onto things like the financial impact and the mental health impact, have any of you got anything in place to try and tackle these issues? Again, opening it up to the floor if anyone wants to step in.
Perhaps one of the biggest positives that came out of the virus was that people stepped forward to volunteer, to help out, to reach out to people more than we've ever seen perhaps in a generation. I think some people have been a little bit burnt out from that now. We're finding volunteering has become more difficult to find as people sort of go back to normality in terms of their lives and fit those other things in. But yes, for sure, I think it doesn't help the fact that now we're emerging from COVID, we're faced with the cost of living crisis, and people who have been impacted by COVID and now having to deal with the cost of living rising. We're very fortunate as a community. We have a hardship fund in which we're able to assist people financially, with meals, with befriending and other types of support, through and a tremendous amount of volunteering as well. But I think we yet to see the full impact of it. And I think yes, it's the next thing we're going to have to really be dealing with as we move forward.
And have you seen the demand for the synagogue's help grow, I assume, during the pandemic?
Yeah, absolutely.
And
definitely.
Do you expect it to grow further, or do you think it will level off?
All I'll say is we don't expect it to drop.
Are you apprehensive about that as a community leader?
Obviously, we're concerned that the growing financial burden and how we are able to provide for people who are in real need. You know, we have volunteers who cook freshly cooked meals on a weekly basis to distribute, and the numbers of people asking for those is growing all the time.
And Daniel, do you have systems in place where people can come to you to ask for help?
Well, so we filter that through what we call our front door, which is the Jewish Care Helpline, Jewish Care Direct desk, and there's a whole team of people that take those calls day in, day out, and the volume of calls has gone up significantly, as you'd imagine, through the pandemic, as people needed assistance. I think one of the biggest challenges that the older community has faced, of course, is that people have been, you know, locked up in their homes for much of the last 2 years, and where they've been living with conditions, where they've been needing support, in many cases, the needs have sped up much more quickly than they might ordinarily have done if people were engaged, stimulated, out, as Raymond was saying, being physically together with other people. So what we're seeing now is an increased demand for much more complex care and support coming through, alongside, of course, what is the second part of this pandemic, which is the mental health pandemic. And colleagues will know that we work very closely with a partner, a sister organisation, Jamie, that sits as part of the organisation. And certainly demand for Jamie's services and our own mental health services has increased significantly in the last few months as we kind of come out of this period of lockdown sagas.
Now, I just add to what Daniel's saying is that what we find people presenting with mental health issues, and we try to support them and with the other Jewish organisations as well. But what we find is that the statutory organisations, what they're able to offer is getting less and less, and that is really putting greater pressure on the Jewish community, on a limited pool of funds and people, to be able to provide for our community. So that's the real challenge, that we're not getting, that there isn't the help out there from the statutory organisations, and the burden is therefore falling on the communal and care organisations, and I think that's a real concern for us all.
And where do you think the breaking point will be? Because I assume that certain Jewish communities will only be able to take so much of the burden, so much of the pressure, before they have to either turn people away or have to change their approach to take on more people and put more resources, etc.
I mean, Jack, I can give you an example of that. I think it's less about that. I think it's more about we will probably be forced to have to make some choices about what we can and can't do. And certainly at Jewish Care, we are continuing to look at what it is possible for us to do, what's important for us to do, and what other people can do, what other providers can provide. And fundamentally, that comes down to what is distinctively Jewish about what we do. And if we can't demonstrate that something is distinctively Jewish, frankly, we will say to ourselves and the community, other people can do these things, and we are in the middle of that in some of our services right now. So I think we will have to make some choices. We're already making choices, but that's probably the history of the organisation and the communities that we represent. We always have to make choices because there is not a bottomless pit of money for us to utilise.
So you perhaps say that there is a slight moral dilemma at one point where you have to say, how much do we want to help people outside of the community, and how much do we have to focus on our own community?
No, sorry, I should be clearer about what I meant. I'm not saying that we will make choices about whether we support people inside or outside the community. What I'm saying is that there are some things that we've historically done that you can't necessarily evidence as being a distinctively Jewish service. So the example for Jewish Care is domiciliary home care, sending carers to work in people's own homes. My view is that it's harder to demonstrate the Jewishness of that service versus providing a community that people can live in and live a Jewish life. And therefore, if there are other providers outside the community that can provide those services, we will direct them to those things more directly.
I think that the point Daniel makes is so important, which is, in the words of our chair, Mark Noy, he often says, strategy is sacrifice. So at the moment, when we're thinking strategically about, there are limited funds out there finances are a push for everyone, we're going to have to make decisions, and some things have to be sacrificed at the expense of others. What none of us want to do is sacrifice anything that hurts people. But if there is someone else that can pick up that service, then they should be doing it. I think we all offer something, you know, unique. So we have a couple of programs. I'll give you an example. Gateways is our program that works with young Jewish students, aged sort of 14 to 21, mostly from Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox backgrounds, who are at risk. These are youth at risk. They have mental health issues, anxiety, eating disorders. There's drugs, there's behavioural issues, domestic abuse. And they're being potentially failed by the school system, or the school system can't really cope with them in a class of 30. And for 6 or 7 years, we've been running a programme that we do this one-on-one vocational and academic lessons at JDW3. It cost us a lot of money. We fundraise, you know, very heavily to do it. And suddenly in the last 18 months, the demand for it has just, it's been unprecedented because, as Daniel said, the mental health crisis has hit that target group, but particularly because they've been, when they were in lockdown and they weren't seeing their friends and they weren't running around in a school playground and they weren't, they were stuck at home. And so these issues they had just grew and grew. With the issues at JFS, with some of the other stuff that is well reported in the community, our phone does not stop ringing with parents saying, oh, I've heard great things about this program. Can you fit my kid on it? And we can't. We're at capacity with it. We have a waiting list on it. We won't. What we choose to do is to keep the quality of the provision at the level it needs to be. And we won't forego that just to fit more people in. At the absolute other end of the scale, when we're sort of talking about how we respond, you've got a whole load of our programme, which we partner with GPG, Genesis Philanthropy Group, who support an area of our programme we call micro-communities. We're working with different groups in the community. It comes back to my point about being open is not about a building, it's about a mindset. It's about how we as Jewish people should be, about being open to people, about treating people, B'Tselem Elokim. Right, as if everybody was created in the image of God, we're all equal. And different groups, smaller groups in the community, have been more marginalised during this period. So it could be LGBTQ Jews, it could be Jews of colour, it could be, you know, different kinds of Jewish groups who have just struggled to find their place in community because they've been in lockdown and with all the restrictions. And we've created these groups with the support of GPG, which are micro communities, giving them a space where we say the Jewish community welcomes you in. You can explore your multiple Jewish identities in person with other people in a safe space. Meet people with the same perspective and meet people with other perspective, but don't be overly worried about the fact you can't afford it. So a lot of these programs we're doing as a pay what you can, which is a different model for us. We didn't do that before, but pay what you can in the hope that the balance between what we get funded and what the person can afford to pay can just about make it work. But instead of having a year-long budget that we know we can stick to, we're having to reforecast and readjust as we go along to make sure we don't let people down in the services that they most need from us.
So I think that's really interesting, because I think that is one of the major lessons that we've learned during this time. So we talk about us as religious communities. We tend to be very slow to change. Even us as liberals tend to be very slow. Change takes a very long time. And I think during COVID, we all adapted massively. However we did it, we adapted. Our community was incredible at its adaption. And I think that I hope that that's one thing we don't lose, is our ability to be responsive in a way that's not just firefighting, but actually is kind of thinking that we're able to let go. Something works, something doesn't work. We can let go. We can change who our partners are, how we work together. I think has been a real strength of our community during this time, and not one that naturally comes to us.
I also think it's important to note that it's not all doom and gloom, like the impact of the pandemic. Again, another positive that's come out of the pandemic is, you know, when unfortunately we weren't able to have the large charity dinners as fundraisers, the community adapted again, and these match funding campaigns have just blown people away in terms of how people have responded to them to raise the amounts of money without even a plate of food put in front of you. So, you know, there is, people are still willing and recognise the importance and the value of
I think some people were paying not to go to those dinners, Alex, actually.
Right, I think people realise that they continue to acknowledge the importance of our communal organisations, and are willing to put their hands in their pockets, perhaps not to go, as you say, but to make sure that we can continue. I think that's a real positive we should take out of it. And yeah, and you're absolutely right in terms of the being able to adapt. You know, we're undertaking the process of reimagining community at the moment and really asking us some fundamental questions of all the things we've taken for granted over the generations, because we see this now not as just we see this actually as something positive, a once in a generation opportunity to actually ask some fundamental questions about the things we've taken for granted forever, about why are people involved in community, and actually challenge those, because those have been thrown up in the air, and we can't just rely on, oh, it was things we always used to do, because that's not how it works anymore. So it's really given us an opportunity to think freshly and reimagine things for the better.
That's it from the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group. Through its partners, GPG is working to support the growth of Jewish community life in the UK and worldwide. To find out more, visit www.gpg.org. All that's left for me to do is thank my guests, Daniel Carmel Brown, Rabbi Alex Chapa, Rabbi Charlie Baginski, Raymond Simonson, Leo Mindell and Michael Daventry for their work in post-production, and you for listening. Please do subscribe to the show in your podcast application. That way you'll hear any previous episode or be informed when new episodes become available. Don't forget that for more information on any of the stories that we've featured, you can always go to jewishnews.co.uk. If you'd like to comment, then we'd love to hear from you on editorial@jewishnews.co.uk. That's editorial@jewishnews.co.uk. From me, Jack Mendel, do join us next time here on the Jewish News Podcast. Goodbye.